Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet, and I am, for once, not in Edinburgh. I'm in Charlottesville, and I'm joined by Frank Cagliano, who is also in Charlottesville.
Yay! We're together!
Yes, and so, as many listeners know, we've been doing this show at some distance for much of this year, but now we're together, and we're doing it in America. So, yeah, this is weird.
It is weird. It is weird. We're on the road. In fact, that's our theme. So we're going to do something a little different today. The Mueller report dropped this morning, but those careful listeners will remember that I said we need to read the thing and digest it before we render a verdict. And because it dropped this morning, all I've read is tweets, so I don't think we'll discuss it today.
No, and plus I think it's a third of it's redacted anyway. So.
Right, so we will probably return to that, I suspect, or we'll certainly return to some of the issues that have been raised by the Mueller report. What we want to do today, which is a little bit different, is I want to interview David about his recent book, because David is here because he's on a book tour. So think of this as... It's like public radio. It's local public radio. It's Book Corner with Professor Cagliano. Today we have an author. So I want to. David is on a tour of the United States of the Southern United States, yes. Really, yep. For a few weeks.
And most of the surrenders happen in the South.
So and yeah. Talking about his book on surrender in the Civil War, and I thought we'd take a few minutes and chat about his book and give him an opportunity to tell you what he's been doing, what
yes.
He does other than the Whiskey Rebellion. So
I do a few other things.
You yes. Do, I know that. But so David, give us the pitch. Tell us about your book.
So the book really begins with a very...
What's it called?
Oh, it's called... Sorry, yes.
He's not very experienced in these kinds of things.
I thought the host of the show was supposed to do those kinds of bibliographic things. Anyway.
excuse me.
The name of the book is Raising the White Flag, How Surrender Defined the American Civil War. And the basic premise of the book, the idea that started the whole thing, was this realization that they surrendered a lot in the Civil War. So
who's they?
Both the Union and the Confederacy. So the war begins with a surrender at Fort Sumter. It ends with a series of surrenders at Appomattox Courthouse and Bennett Place and a dozen other sites. And in between, many of the major battles in the war culminate not in a sort of outright victory, but in a surrender. So we can think of Fort Donelson, we can think of Vicksburg, Harper's Ferry. And so, you know, the original idea I wanted to make sense of in the book is, why are they surrendering so often? What was it about the nature of warfare that led both Union and Confederate armies to surrender so frequently? How did they make sense of surrender, and ultimately, what does that tell us about the Civil War as a conflict? You know, there's no other war in American history where they surrendered nearly as much, and you'd be hard pressed to find any other wars in all of human history where surrender was such a ubiquitous phenomenon.
So, well, God, there's a lot to unpack there. Just following on that last statement, do we see it in other conflicts during the mid-19th century? Is this a 19th century thing? Do you see it in the Crimean War, for example, or the Franco-Prussian War?
Not really. I mean, you see it some. I mean, it's people surrender sometimes, but not the dozens and dozens of times like they do in the Civil War. You know, you find it, for instance, you know, going back into your century, you find it in the Revolution.
You do find it in the War of Independence,
You know, the War of Independence, sorry. The two major turning points or major sort of events in that war, in fact, surrenders in Saratoga and Yorktown. You find some surrenders in the War of 1812. You find some surrenders in the Mexican War, but nothing, those sort of pale in comparison to the Civil War in terms of its frequency. In terms of, you know, European conflicts, you do find some surrenders happening in Napoleonic Wars and in the Crimea and other places. But again, it's something that happens once or twice, not over and over again.
Well, we tell ourselves that the Civil War is especially bloody because it's a civil war.
Yeah.
But do we have this culture of surrender also because it's a civil war, that these are people from the same culture and they're
right.
Familiar to each other and so on?
Yeah, so one of the sort of meta arguments of the books, we do tend to think of the Civil War as a particularly bloody war. There's the old number is 620,000, the new number is 750,000 people killed. Whatever it is, it's the bloodiest war in American history by a long shot. And we often, you know, think and write about the Civil War in those terms, and especially recently historians have been very interested in really the brutality of the Civil War, the way in which it impacted those who died, those and those who lived. One of the things I think I was trying to do in the book, in some ways, is say, well, yes, the war was extraordinarily bloody, and there's a lot of people lost their lives. But imagine how much bloodier the war would have been if the people who surrendered in the war were not allowed to surrender, right? If, you know, there are approximately 700,000 people who surrender in the war, so the number of people who surrender is about the same number of people who are killed. You know, if those people had not been allowed to put down their weapons and allowed to, you know, during the war either go to a prison or be paroled, or at the end of the war be paroled and allowed to go home, you know, that's a very, it's an order of magnitude more bloody, right? You know, imagine what would have happened if, after the sieges of, you know, the siege of Vicksburg, if the Confederates hadn't surrendered there and Grant was forced to assault a fortified position, right? How many men lived that day because of the surrender that would not have lived had that culminating battle actually taken place? And you sort of play that over the course of the war, it would have been orders of magnitude more gruesome. You know, were surrender not on the table.
How did you come to write on this? I mean, how did you settle on this topic? How do you pick a topic?
So the way most historians answer this question when they ask how they came to the topic is they read something somewhere and they are in the archives and some light came on in their head. This actually came to me in a dream. No, seriously, this came to me in a dream. I have
Listeners, I know that we're a team, but I also want to make clear that David speaks only for himself. Anyway, carry on, David.
Yes, my dream life is very personal to me.
Don't share a dream life.
No. So this may be more autobiographical than people want, but I suffer from fairly chronic nightmares. I have a fairly vivid and unpleasant unconscious state when I'm at night.
You watch too many superhero movies.
This predates the superhero movie genre, unless you include the Superman movies from the late 70s. And those aren't going to inspire any nightmares. Actually, maybe they have. This one particular night, I had a notepad next to my bed, and I remember waking up at 3 in the morning, writing down surrender and civil war, and then going back to sleep. And woke up the next day and said, hey, that seems like a decent enough idea. I mean, it really was a very simple idea. You know, I often find the best research questions are very simple ones. And I was surprised when I started on this project, because it really is a very simple idea, and because the Civil War has more written about it than anybody can read in a lifetime. There's been a book written on the war every day since the war ended, and that was 150 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. There's a lot of books. Most of them are bad. I can't actually say it with authority because no one's read all of them. But there's two books for every hour of the war, including all the times when people are asleep. So there's a lot written. So I was surprised, really, that no one has written this book before, because in some ways it's the reaction that I've had in the past couple weeks going around talking about this book is, oh, well, that's obvious. But it's sort of obvious that no one's done it. I'm not quite sure why that is. Obviously, people have written very cogently about these surrenders as individual events of Fort Sumter. Has a whole, a library of things written on Appomattox, likewise, Vicksburg, and what have you. But sort of putting them together and thinking about what these meant for people 150 years ago and the ways in which they processed them. That was remarkable. No one's done that before. So
what's the historiographical takeaway then from this?
I think it's that I think people who are fighting the Civil War really thought they were fighting in a civilized conflict. With some limits to it, though, and I'll mention that.
So Civil War takes on two meanings in that context.
So they thought that war had rules, and, and they expected not only themselves to play by the rules, but by their enemy to abide by the rules. And surrender is part of that. They had a rubric they developed very early on in the war about when one could surrender honorably. And basically, if you've been fired upon, you have no opportunity to win the battle. You can't win. You can't effectively retreat. Under those circumstances, both Union and Confederates believed that that was a perfectly legitimate reason to surrender. If you sort of met that threshold,
but there was no dishonor in it.
In fact, you could be not only no dishonor, it could be seen as honorable and heroic to surrender under the circumstances. And the best example.
Would it be dishonorable not to surrender?
You would be seen as wasting the lives of your men,
right.
That would have been abrogating your obligations as an officer.
So you're going to give an example.
So the sort of example 1A of this is Robert Anderson, who commands Fort Sumter. He, after the surrender, he's allowed to leave with his garrison, the 50-something guys with him. They go to New York City, and he is greeted by a parade that would have been appropriate had he been a victorious general winning a war. And he is described as the hero of Fort Sumter, and his garrison as the hero Fort Sumter heroes. And he gets a promotion and all other kinds of things. And he's praised not only by people in the North, he's praised by people in the South as a heroic figure for the ways in which the I imagine most listeners know the story of Fort Sumter pretty well, but his garrison, they are demanded, the Confederates demand that they surrender, they refuse, they're bombarded for 34 hours from multiple sides. The Confederates have had this very lengthy siege of the fort. The fort's on fire. It looks like the magazine with the gunpowder and other explosives was about to explode, and then he surrenders. And because he put himself at risk, because he did everything he could not to surrender, and then chose to surrender rather than allowing, his men to die, that made him not only sort of honorable but heroic. And you really see this all the way through to the end of the war. There's an example from the very, very, very end of the war, from May of 1865, so actually a month after Appomattox, after most of the Confederate armies have surrendered, and after Jefferson Davis is captured. There's basically one big army left, and that's Edmund Kirby Smith's army in Texas and western Louisiana. And the Union Army sends out a courier and says, hi, I don't know if you know what's been going on in the East, but everyone else has given up. Are you willing to surrender? And Kirby Smith says, basically, I'd like to, but I can't. And he writes this very lengthy letter, and he says, basically, the obligation of an officer is not to surrender until he has no other choice. And the sort of the subtext of it is, I can't surrender yet because you haven't attacked me yet. When you guys attack me, then I can feel I can honorably surrender. But as a officer, I don't feel I've met that threshold yet. And so it's a standard that really sort of holds through for both armies for the duration of the war. That's sort of the standard they have for officers. The other standard is the standard they have for soldiers. One of the things I found is that in every Civil War battle, thousands of soldiers are choosing to surrender individually on the battlefield. In most battles, in fact, there are more people who surrender than are killed, which makes you think about Civil War battles in a very different way. And they are almost never criticized for choosing to surrender on a battlefield, in large part because in order to do so, you need to get very close to the enemy. You need to be close enough where they can see you, where they can hear you. And given all the smoke and the noise of a Civil War battlefield, the people who are captured, people who surrender, are usually not the ones who are cowards. They're the ones running away to the back. They're usually the last ones to retreat when everyone else in the regiment has run away. Those people are almost never criticized for their choice to surrender.
I've written a little bit about prisoners during the American Revolution, and you've obviously, surrender leads to imprisonment.
Yes.
But in both conflicts, there was an issue because one of the belligerents was rebelling and seeking to achieve its independence from the other.
Yeah.
And by definition, whether it's the Union or the British Empire, the other belligerent refused to recognize the legitimacy of their opponent. And that poses a problem for prisoners of war. Whether you treat people as prisoners of war or rebels, for example, actually has important implications in international law, for example. Does that figure in your book at all?
It does a little bit at the beginning, right? So at the very beginning, the Lincoln administration is very conscious of the fact that they don't want to do anything to legitimize the Confederacy under international law, and they really bend over backwards. You know, Lincoln often refers to it as the so-called Confederacy. And he talks very much about, as you know, Lincoln thinks that secession was unconstitutional, and therefore we have states that are in rebellion but are still part of the Union, and there's a very convoluted train of thought going on there. So initially the Lincoln administration is apprehensive about how they deal with prisoners of war as a consequence of that. After the first year of the war, though, I think there's lots of public pressure to engage in prisoner exchange with the Confederacy, and they open in July of 1862 the Dix Hill Cartel, which is a prisoner exchange regime that basically empties all the POW camps that existed in the first year of the war. And it's a process by which prisoners are basically released on a promise not to fight again. They're what's called paroled, in which they would pledge on their honor not to fight until they're told they're allowed to. And the sort of second part of the process is they'd be exchanged for another prisoner on the other side. And so after a period of time, after being paroled, you'd be told, look, you've been exchanged, and now you can go back and fight with your regiment. You know, when people think of Civil War prisons and the experience of people who are prisoners during the Civil War, they tend to think of places like Andersonville, which is Confederate prison, a prison for Union soldiers.
Or Elmira, right?
Or Elmira. I mean, there are all these other prisons. And that really, and these are really horrible places. If you read descriptions of them, there are a number of excellent prison diaries from a number of these places. Those are actually all from 1864. And that's from a very specific period of time in which these prisons grew very large. For most of the rest of the war, soldiers' descriptions of prisons are actually relatively benign. In part because they're in prison very briefly, the prisons are not very crowded because they aren't very impressive, and then they are quickly released. And the Dix Hill Cartel is part of the reason why people spend very little time in prison for the sort of middle third of the war. That's an agreement, though, that breaks down in 1863, at the end of 1863 and into 1864, basically for two reasons. One, both sides accuse the other of cheating, of exchanging more prisoners than they were entitled to. But the more important reason is the Confederacy refused to recognize African Americans as legitimate soldiers. They said, look, if we capture African Americans in Union uniform, we're going to treat them as runaway slaves and return them to slavery. And the Union says, in response, if you don't treat all of our soldiers like soldiers when they are captured, you are breaking the terms of our deal. And therefore we're calling the deal off until you do. And that basically remains the situation from late 1863 until early 1865. And that's when you end up with Andersonville and Elmira and Point Lookout and these other kinds of really horrific Civil War prisons.
Wait, David, are you suggesting that the Civil War was about slavery?
I'm not suggesting that at all, Frank. I'm saying that explicitly. Yeah, okay. The Civil War is about slavery. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you for clarifying that point.
And I'm saying that on the campus here of the University of Virginia, so that may be fighting words for some people around here. But anyway.
Well, that brings us to your tour. So you've been on tour, David. It's a glamorous rock star lifestyle. Would you like to tell us about it? Give us an insight into what it's like to be David Silkenhout on the road.
Oh, jeez. So I got to this here about 2 weeks ago?
Yes.
Losing track of time.
It's April 18th.
Today. Okay, so a little bit less than 2 weeks ago. And so I've been going to a variety of places, half of which are university venues and half of which are museums and national park sites. So I've been to spoke at Andersonville, which is the site of the prison where they have a museum, the National Museum of of prisoners of war there. And so I spoke there. I spoke at Appomattox. They had the 154th anniversary of Lee's surrender to Grant at Appomattox, and so I was there, and that was great fun because they had the reenactment of the surrender. The last chapter of the book looks at the memory of surrender and the ways in which it's been commemorated or not, and so I actually got to talk to some of the guys who were in the book as figures in the book at this reenactment.
You mean reenactors who were in the book?
Book, yeah, reenact. Right. But I've mentioned, for instance, I talk at some length in the book about the 150th anniversary of some of these surrenders, and so some of the guys who were at the 154th were there 4 years ago.
How do they reenact a surrender? I mean, I understand how they reenact battles and why these guys who like to reenact battles, but reenacting a surrender is a kind of interesting genre of the reenacting world.
Well, they've done different things in the past. Sometimes they have the two guys go into the McLean house, and then they have somebody give a lecture outside while they're busy faking having the negotiations inside. Then they come out, and Lee rides off on his horse. What they did this year is they had basically a two-man play with a guy who was reenacting Grant and the guy who was reenacting Lee, talking about the 48 hours of sort of leading up to Appomattox and talking about, they sort of read some of the documents and they did it in character. It was quite touching. They also have large numbers of soldiers who go and stack arms, and so they reenact the Union soldiers standing at parade rest and then having the Confederates march up and stack their arms and roll up their flags and then walk off. And they have guys getting parole slips. And so they have if you go to Appomattox Courthouse, whether it's the anniversary or not, they print up little parole slips so you can take them home as souvenirs. And so they do that. So it's a more of a living history kind of thing than a battle reenactment.
Right, but a lot of, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is a lot of the reenactors, especially the Confederate reenactors, are especially interested in the military aspects of the war, the military history of the war.
Yeah.
And is it fair to say many of them might be subscribers to the Lost Cause interpretation?
Well, so one of the things that's generally true about reenactors is there tends to be far more people are interested in reenacting the Confederacy
right.
than there is in the Union. And that's been true for a very long time. And that was true last weekend at Appomattox. Despite the fact that there were far more Union soldiers at Appomattox 154 years ago than there were Confederate soldiers, that was not necessarily on display last weekend. And I think they do...
But how do they feel about surrender?
Surrender. I think they have very mixed feelings about it. I remember I was taking pictures, actually, of the reenactment of the stacking of arms, and the person next to me with her big fancy camera said, said this always makes me sad. And I said, why? She said, because I'm from Virginia, as if that was the sort of totality of explanation needed. There weren't a huge number of reenactors. So if you go to sort of Gettysburg or something, that attracts a huge number of people who want to reenact it. There were a few hundred people there over the weekend. So by reenactment standards, it was pretty small. As to the you mentioned earlier, the sort of the politics of these the people doing the reenactments. I think there's a mixed bag. After the play on the steps of the McLean House, I went and spent that evening around some of the campfires with the reenactors because I figure how many opportunities am I going to have to hang out around campfires with the reenactors?
With your beef jerky and harmonica?
I was wearing
a hard tack.
Yeah, I had none of that. I was wearing khakis and a polo shirt, I think. So anyway, I did not dress up, although several of them told me I should. And I got the impression, going from several different campfires, that some of them have I say impression is the wrong word. I got clear evidence that some of them had fairly retrograde ideas about racial politics, about the Civil War, about its origins, much of which I think were rooted in the Lost Cause. You know, some of these guys have been doing this for 30 years, and so I think part of it is, they may have gotten interested in it as a consequence of their interest in the Civil War, but it becomes a thing in and of itself.
Would it have been different if you'd been sitting by the campfire of Union troops, do you
think? Yeah, in retrospect, I should have probably visited them. There weren't very many Union troops, to be honest with you. But yeah, and next time I'm there, I'll make sure I'll spend more time in the Union camp.
And you met Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant, yes. their avatars.
Avatars, yes. And the avatar of Traveler, Robert E. Lee's horse, who I believe his real name is Zeus. They have many of the other figures they are reenacted. So Charles Marshall, who was Lee's aide and in the room when it happened, to steal a metaphor, line from a different time period. So they have reenactors of several of the figures. They had descendants of some of the figures. So Grant's great nephew was there, and Joshua Chamberlain's descendant was there, which was interesting to sort of meet them, because they seem to have gone to this third thing every year for the past 40 years. And it was interesting to interact with that kind of public, because they were clearly, the people who show up at Appomattox, and for those of you who haven't been to Appomattox, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's not a highly visited site. So people who go to the 154th anniversary are people who are really dedicated to this particular moment, although I think each of them is bringing a different set of ideas about what they think it means and how they should think about it. Should we think about Appomattox as a tragic event? Should they think about it as a heroic moment? Should they think about it as a birth of a new nation? How should they think about what transpired there, and who is the hero of the story? Who are the villains of the story, if you have to have villains? You listening to people talk about what they thought it meant and why they were there was very interesting.
So, leaving aside the reenacting element to it, when you're on your tour, we're going to have an event this afternoon, for example. But what happens? What do you do?
What do I do? I talk about a couple of the episodes in the book. I talk about some of the things we've been talking about this afternoon. So questions about why they surrendered so often, the way they made sense of it, who was allowed to surrender, who wasn't allowed to surrender. One of the big questions that the book is trying to wrestle with is if most soldiers can surrender, and we have 700,000 soldiers who can surrender, which soldiers aren't allowed to surrender? There's some clear boundaries that both the Union and Confederacy have over who they don't let to surrender. The Confederacy doesn't allow African Americans to surrender. The official policy is that that African Americans are runaway slaves and should be returned to bondage. In practice, the Confederate policy in many cases is to execute captured African Americans in uniform. And so they are basically not allowed to surrender. And we have a number of well-documented cases of that. African Americans, on the flip side, say, well, if they don't accept our surrender, we're not going to let them surrender. And so, that changes the nature of the ways in which African Americans, the battles in which African Americans are present are different as a consequence of that, because the rules of combat change.
So you talk about these kinds of things when you do your book talk.
Yeah. And there's a similar kind of rubric involved for guerrillas who are also considered not to be legitimate soldiers, and for Southern Unionists who white Southerners who fight for the Union, because they're considered deserters from the Confederate Army, so they're not allowed to surrender either.
So is there do you get a different, I want to find out about the audience response, is it different if you speak at a university as you're going to do today than if you speak at a historic site? Have you noticed a difference?
I have not noticed a difference yet. I do notice a difference in the questions people ask after the lecture when I'm still up at the podium, and the questions they ask me 5 minutes after everybody leaves when they come up to me and talk to me privately.
And ask you what they really want to ask.
Yeah,
yeah. So what is that difference?
Well, the one thing that's come up twice now is the question of black Confederates. What happens when black Confederates surrender? And
do you want to, not all of our listeners are Civil War experts.
Yeah, I was just figuring out how to unpack this. So there is part of the sort of lost cause mythology that has emerged, especially in the past couple of decades, is this idea that there were a large number of African Americans who fought for the Confederacy. Listeners, there are no African Americans who fought for the Confederacy. At the very end, the word Confederacy considers arming African Americans, and then they don't, because the war ends. But this, there's a robust mythology that they did in large numbers. And the subtext of the argument about black Confederates is if African Americans fought for the Confederacy, then clearly the war wasn't about slavery, because otherwise they wouldn't have done this. But they didn't do this because the war was about slavery. Anyway, and so I've on two occasions had people ask me about what happens when black Confederates surrender, and which I have to explain that there were no black Confederates. The Confederate Army traveled with lots of African American slaves who cooked their meals and pulled their wagon, helped with wagons and animals and things. But there were no African Americans in Confederate regiments.
And were both of those questions asked after, at the end?
At the end, in those sort of in the moments, you know, after the lectures, as I'm backing up. What that tells me, I think, is the people who are asking that question know that they're not going to get a good reaction if they ask that question in front of a larger audience. And I think they're trying to figure out who I am. Because depending on my answer to that question, situates me within, you know, a different framework. And I try to explain to them that there weren't any black Confederates. And there's a really great book that's going to come out in a few months by Kevin Levin on the myth of black Confederates. It tries to unpack why this particular myth, and there's lots of myths attached to this, about why this emerged, when and how it has, and why it's really based in nothing. But that's been the big sort of divide thus far.
What have been some of the other responses to it?
I think, you know, there's been some questions about, you know, whether surrender was in Lee's nature, which I think were surprising.
And so they kind of go to Appomattox then.
They go to Appomattox and they say, well, you know, it wasn't in Lee's nature surrender, but he did, and that demonstrates something about him. And the response I always have to that is, well, when you say it wasn't in Lee's nature, what is that based on? Like, what is the argument you're making for why, you know, Lee hated surrender so much? And I think, you know, there's no documentary evidence to support that claim. I think that is merely people having a vision of who they want Lee to be, and therefore, when he does something contrary to what they want him to be, then they have to explain that. In some ways, it sort of reminded me of, in a weird way, the Sally Hemings debate with Jefferson, where people said, well, Jefferson couldn't have done this because it wasn't in his nature.
Right.
Which supposes that you know his nature and therefore you can understand what he could or could not have done. I'm not sure I understand anybody's nature, including my own, but I definitely don't understand.
But given what you've said about the role of assumptions about honor and civilization and so on, if we subscribe to the kind of stereotype of Lee as this incredibly honorable man, then surrender would be in his nature.
Yeah, and he knew lots of people who had surrendered. You know, if you're looking at who's in Lee's army, I mean, a bunch of those guys had surrendered before, you know, and so, you know, they, when they come to Appomattox, they know what surrender is. If you look at Grant obviously walks into the room in the McLean parlor, and, you know, he's one who has participated in two big surrenders previously at Fort Donelson and at Vicksburg. So he knows how this works, right? And so they are not neophytes to it. I think one of the things that's going on is there's a a language in the United States that says Americans never surrender that develops in the 20th century. You know, you find President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, during that big televised speech, he says, there's one thing Americans will never do and Americans will never surrender. And you find variations of the statement being uttered really by every American politician in the second half of the 20th century, of both political parties. In fact, if you want to find something that they agree on, it's that Americans never surrender. And so then how do you make sense then of a war in which people are surrendering all the time? And I think that's part of the struggle. I mean, that may be why no one has written this book before, is because we have this notion that Americans don't surrender, that they'll fight to the last man. And you find that really throughout American culture. It's not just a political statement, you know. There's a whole, if you can, one can make a whole Spotify list of songs that the central theme of which is, you know, we don't surrender, I don't surrender. As if that is something deeply unhonorable and un-American to do. You know, and with all apologies to Bruce Springsteen, I think there's a period of time 150 years ago in which people saw surrender as a legitimate choice and one that wasn't, you know, giving in. It was making a wise choice to choose not to fight rather than to fight a battle that you can't win.
Have you encountered any hostility? I mean, I see where the Black Confederates thing is a subtext thing, but
surprisingly, not yet. And I'm going to be at a and I've spoken on this book now 6 or 7 times, and I will doing sort of another half dozen events after this one. And I've found surprisingly little hostility, in part because, you know, the argument of the book isn't just about Confederates surrendering at the end. It's about both Union and Confederates surrendering throughout the war. And so it's, you know, if I had just written about Confederate surrenders at the end of the war at Appomattox Courthouse and afterwards, I could see someone attacking that as being hostile to, you know, the lost cause or whatever, you know, that kind of. But part of the argument of the book is really this isn't something that's just the Confederates doing. That's something the Union Army does plenty of times, too. And so that it's something that is, in fact, is a shared, it's about the sort of the shared language and rules of war. We'll see how other places respond. I'm going to be, among the places I'm going to go speak at Bennett Place in a little bit over a week, which is one of the other big surrenders. I'm going to be in Richmond on Saturday speaking. I'm going to be up near Harper's Ferry in a couple weeks, which is the site of the largest Union surrender in the war. So I will see whether different audiences respond differently. But thus far people have been nice to me.
Well, good. I'm pleased to hear it.
I'm a very sensitive soul, so if people are mean to me, I don't think I'm...
Do you think you'd get a different response if you were giving these talks in the North?
So I am going into West Virginia, so that's Union territory. Although whether West Virginia is in the North is a matter of some debate, I guess.
Especially now. It might have been then, but it may not be now.
Exactly. Where does the South begin? Where does it end? We'll see. I'm hoping to do some more talks in the North in July, but I haven't figured out.
If you were in Pennsylvania or Massachusetts. Or...
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I'll find out. Hopefully.
But we can return to this. I've got one provocative question to end on.
Yes.
And I am asking this with tongue firmly in cheek, particularly because I'm somebody who's writes about the Founding Fathers, for God's sake. You mentioned a book published for every day of the war.
Yes.
Do we have too many books on the Civil War, David? Do we need more books on the Civil War? Are we done? Should we be done?
Looking forward to my professional career, which is hopefully going to last at least another few years, I hope the answer is no, we're not done. I think, and I don't know whether my book is a particularly good example of that, but I think it is. There are still new questions we need to ask about the Civil War, and I think we are in the process right now of, and we have been for several years, of refiguring and reframing what the Civil War is about, rethinking about, you know, who is included in the Civil War and who's not, the ways in which the Civil War is connected to Reconstruction, Many of our listeners may have been watching the recent PBS series on Reconstruction, making sense of the Civil War era more broadly. I think we're really in a phenomenally interesting time to in which we are rethinking some very basic assumptions about how the Civil War works. And so, I think there's still a lot left to say. And even if we have a huge amount written, I think that's because there's an appetite for it. I mean, people are still phenomenally interested in the Civil War. And the talks I've given thus far, I've been very lucky to have very large audiences. And I don't think that's me. I think that's because anytime you put Civil War in the title of something, people show up because they want to hear about it. And so I think that says there's still a lot left to say.
Excellent. Well, we should end on that note. Yes. David, do you have a last drop for this week?
I mentioned this earlier, but I want to encourage people to visit Appomattox Courthouse if you are ever in that part of Virginia, or even if you're not in that part of Virginia, because it's a very pretty part of Virginia.
It's about 40 miles south of here, isn't it, Dory?
Yeah, it's a little bit further than that, but not much. There's some winding country roads between here and there, so it's pretty countryside. And there are two sites to visit at Appomattox Courthouse. You've got the National Park Service site, which has the McLean House, which is actually a reconstruction, a number of the other buildings connected with the surrender. And there's a museum about a mile down the street that is what was the Appomattox branch of the Museum of the Confederacy, but is now the Appomattox branch of the American Civil War Museum. And they have an amazing collection of artifacts there attached, connected to the surrender. They've got Lee's uniform and his sword. They've got lots of other sort of uniforms and things connected with the surrender. And so I highly recommend a visit to Appomattox Courthouse. And if you guys can go on the anniversary, all the more better. So what do you got in terms of
life? I think I've mentioned this already, but you and I were discussing this before we went on the air. We've got some news which is exciting, which is, at Monticello, they have a very interesting oral history project called Getting Word, and Getting Word has been going on since the early 1990s. And the object of the program is to interview the descendants of enslaved people who lived and worked at Monticello, both Jefferson descendants and others, and they have accumulated quite a large catalog of interviews. About 230 people have been interviewed, and they have collected people's family traditions and memories about their experiences both in slavery and afterwards. It's a fascinating, fascinating resource. And I'm pleased to say that we've just learned today that...
This is breaking news.
This is breaking news, people. There
within the past hour.
For Black History Month in the UK, which is in October, there's a small traveling exhibition, a kind of version of Getting Word, that will be coming to Edinburgh. And so we'll have further details, which we can announce as they become available, but we're going to have a small exhibition that will be up in the School of History, Classics, and Archaeology at Edinburgh, from the Getting Word Project, and we're planning a panel discussion with historians, both local talent in Edinburgh, but also from Monticello, as well as descendants, the actual kind of subjects of Getting Word. We're going to have a panel discussion probably at the end of October. So more details to follow, but very, very, I mean, this is a wonderful project. You should check out their website anyway. But
And visit Monticello.
But it's also, of course, visit Monticello. But it's because, among other things, Monticello is probably the best documented slave plantation we have. But it's also, it's very exciting that it's coming to Edinburgh. So I'm pleased to announce that. More details to follow.
Excellent.
But we have to go because you have a book talk to give, and I'm going to heckle you and ask about Black Confederates.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Thanks, right. David. Congratulations.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.